This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our colleagues in public television are, they say, at a crossroads. Though programs like Sesame Street and Masterpiece Theater and The News Hour seem to be a fixed part of the TV constellation, while programs like Frontline continue to broadcast important documentaries and win major awards, the public television system faces serious financial and structural problems. The audience and audience support are down. Corporate sponsorship, what we in public broadcasting call underwriting, that's down too. Program producers complain that the process of getting a show funded and produced is Byzantine and frustrating. And while there's more competition than ever on cable, PBS has not been able to come up with hits to compare to The Daily Show or to The Sopranos. Does public television still play an important role in your life? What could they do better? And do you open your wallet during the fundraising drives? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And before we begin, I should point out that while National Public Radio and PBS are two very different organizations, we do sometimes work together. Also, many of our member stations are dual licensees, radio and television, so they're PBS members as well. Joining us now is Paul Fahrey. He's a Washington Post staff writer. He's with us from the offices of the Washington Post, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
In addition to the structural problems and the finances, we'll get into that in a minute, do you get the sense, Paul, that PBS and public television are adrift, that they've lost a sense of what their purpose is?
They're adrift in the sense that they are one more channel in a sea of channels, an ever-expanding sea. It used to be three networks and PBS. Now it's 300 networks and PBS. They have to find a place amid the Discovery Channels, the Learning Channels, the History Channels that do very, very similar programming to them. This is the kind of issue that faces any brand, any competitor that's trying to stand out in a very crowded field.
Let's begin with a clarification. We tend to think of public television and think of it as we think of NBC or CBS, a network. It's not like that at all, is it?
Well, it's a little different. I mean, it's a network in the sense that they distribute programs to a lot of stations, but the structure is very different. The stations own PBS. That is to say, all of those public stations around the country own PBS, whereas, for instance, in the commercial side, the networks own a small handful of stations, and the rest are merely affiliates. They've signed up to be part of NBC or CBS. It's a little different with PBS. PBS, really strictly speaking, is a distributor of programming. It does produce and generate programming, obviously, but the stations maintain the final say-so as to whether they want to run it or not.
And they have a very important say-so. Issues like carrying one program at one time across the country, so you can advertise in the newspaper, tune in tonight at 9, 8 Central Time, that's impossible to do on public television.
Yeah, this is something that people on the commercial side of network television kind of look at and are just amazed that a network can be run this way. There is no ability to centrally dictate when a program will run. So it might appear at 7 o'clock in one market and 10 a.m. in the next market. That creates difficulties in terms of promoting the program. You can't run a national commercial saying, watch Masterpiece Theater at 10 o'clock because it might not be on at 10 o'clock. So it's a bit chaotic and it's a bit of a balkanized system.
And it's become symbolic of the kind of infighting and the structural problems that have afflicted PBS, or public television, I should say, from the beginning.
Right. Every public station is its own little barony, its own little network, if you will. It decides for itself what it wants to do. It doesn't always agree with what goes on at the network level, at the PBS level. In fact, many times they just refuse to do what PBS would like them to do. It creates a real management headache to operate in this fashion.
And to get a program sold to public television, you don't sell it to PBS. You have to sell it to the stations.
That's right. And then the station takes it up to the PBS level to get it distributed nationally. And you talk to producers and they'll tell you that getting a program cleared on PBS is like going to the DMV. There's a lot of lines you got to go through. And it's a lot of producers, very talented people, don't want to bother with this. That bureaucracy, as a result of this bizarre structure that they have, makes people in the television business say, I'll go to Discovery, I'll go to HBO, I'll go to Showtime, I'll go to some place where I know they can greenlight my production with a lot less hassle than what PBS has to go through.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Terrence, who's with us from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh, hello. I was just speaking earlier when I first heard this topic come up. I'm calling as a 25-year-old. My complaint was that the impression of PBS is that its programming isn't hip. But then this discussion that you just started got me under the impression that even if there were hip programming on PBS, there doesn't seem to be this buzz being generated by the news media, such as Tom Shales and Ken Tucker and some of these prominent critics, Matt Rush, to give people the impression that these would-be good shows are coming to your local affiliate, using local news media to kind of spread the word and let people know that these new shows are actually worth watching. People find out about these shows sometimes if they hear about it from their own local reviewers.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's one way PBS can kind of get around this infighting between the affiliates and just kind of find a way to let the affiliates promote what they are showing.
Well, I'm very sympathetic.
Reviewers get in on the action. Help the publicity.
I'm sorry, but I'm very sympathetic to PBS on this issue. The type of programming that PBS does really is not the kind that's going to appeal to 20-somethings. It's,
yeah.
It's informational, it's politics, it's history. These are not topics that typically 20- and 30-year-olds naturally gravitate toward. Newspapers have pretty much the same problem. We get an older readership. It just so happens that as you age in life, you tend to be more interested in these things. I don't know that PBS can really address that, per se, or that they really should.
They have tried to skew younger with some of their programs, though, Paul. American High, I think, was one such attempt.
Yeah, but if you look at the signature programs of PBS, the most promoted and the staples of the network, you're talking about Mystery, you're talking about Masterpiece Theater, Frontline, NewsHour, Nova, Antiques Roadshow, and then you go way, way down to the children's programming, which is very popular among preschoolers, you know, Barney, Sesame Street, Arthur, etc. There's no middle ground there. Their middle ground really is lacking. And, if I'm PBS, I don't know that I really want to try to dress up and dance for the younger audience. Maybe it's an audience that they're not really going to get.
Two suggestions.
Go ahead.
I'm thinking of movies. One is the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and which, of course, is kind of like chop sake for the caviar set, as Stephen Hunter once said. And the other example might be a show like, I guess, 24, maybe something less violent, that have prominence that get older audiences as well as younger audiences. And, of course, using the local media to let people know that, hey, these shows are on PBS.
Yeah. They do that, and they do promote their programs in front of the TV critics who write all that stuff. So, obviously Fox did a lot of things before they got 24. There was a bunch of other shows that didn't work out so well.
The thing about any television network, of course, is that it has to be self-sustaining and self-perpetuating in its kind of programming philosophy. And if you're going to drop in an American High or some show that you think is going to appeal to young people, you got to keep it going. You can't just do it on a one-shot basis. And PBS, again, informational, historical, political, artistic programming is not right in the wheelhouse of the 20-somethings.
Okay, Terrence, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Kurt, and Kurt's with us from Renton, Washington.
Good. Let's see. It's good afternoon for you, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
First, you have to treat importance of PBS and economic viability of PBS separately, but I'll take care of the important side. It's important to me. I got two PBS stations. I got two NPR stations. What do I need cable for? And the reason for this is that PBS just can do things better than commercial television can. They do news better, like with the NewsHour and with Frontline and things. If you take a science thing, you compare Nova with Discovery. Discovery has to always put that little, oh, golly gee, slant on it. You know, it's not really aimed at the adult mind. And then I have to bring in Coupling, which is the BBC comedy that PBS is running in a lot of markets this year. Funny as heck, NBC put out a lackluster copy of it, which is going to be killed before November. Commercial television, as far as I'm concerned, can't get it right. I watch about three commercial primetime programs a week.
I have to agree with you. I think that when PBS goes and does a subject, it does it better than and smarter than what you will see on the commercial cable side of things. They are simply a brighter, more intelligent, and less commercially driven, which is really the key here, kind of network. And I praise them for it. I think they do serious, serious work. And, Neil, let me just tell you, I mean, it's really ultimately a bargain. The BBC gets a mandatory license fee from every household in Britain with a television set. It raises $4.5 billion a year to do all the things that it does. PBS is one small part of public broadcasting, which from all sources, public radio, public television, raises about $1.8 billion a year. So they're doing things, relatively speaking, on a shoestring.
Okay, Kurt, thanks very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Jeff, who's with us in Detroit, Michigan.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to let you know why I am no longer a member of our local PBS station. I have two complaints about the way they do their programming. First of all, when they do their pledge drives, it's not so much the pledging drive version of it, but they change their programming. They have all these special programs, things that I wouldn't watch in any case, as opposed to the normal programming that I would watch and would pledge to support.
Mm-hmm. Susie Ormond and that sort of thing.
Yes. The other issue is the way they do their blockbuster programming. For example, when the Civil War series was on, it took me a couple of years to see the program because they put it on for 2 or 3 hours a night for 5 days in a row. And there's no way I can make a commitment to watch TV 2 or 3 hours a night, 5 days in a row, whereas I could make a commitment to watch an hour a week for 15 weeks or something along those lines.
Well, Paul Fahrey, the fundraising complaint, that's hardly new.
Well, it's not new, but it's still a scandal. What the caller is saying is absolutely accurate. Many public broadcasting stations will stunt their programming during Pledge Week in order to bring in non-PBS, non-public television viewers. And the reason they do it, obviously, is because they're attempting to raise more money in the pledge drives each time. But what they do is produce and air programming that would never qualify as public broadcasting fare. They will put on the Susie Ormonds, they will put on the Deepak Chopras, they will put on infomercials more or less. And the other thing that this has happened is they've become transactional in nature. In other words, you pledge, you get a book. You pledge, you get a video. It doesn't really build a long-term relationship between the station and the viewer when the sale is all based on merchandise.
And a lot of it is just an open auction on some stations.
Yes, they do that as well. You know, the reason they do it is because they need the money, but they have gravitated to this like crack. They can't wean themselves away from it, and station managers know it sort of has polluted the mission, if you will, of public television. But again, someone's got to come up with a better alternative.
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about the future of public television and PBS, and we want to hear from you, of course. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. When we come back from a short break, Pat Mitchell, the president and CEO of PBS, will join us. So stay tuned for that. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about financial and programming challenges of PBS and public television. Are you a watcher, a donor, a fan? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Public television, public radio too, but public television is known for pledge drives. We've all seen a variation of this pitch, this particular one from Patrick Stoner of WHYY in Philadelphia.
We're tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law, and that's why you should take advantage of that and put your money to work for the community while you take the tax deduction and we get to put on programs like this. This is it. The game is almost over. We're going to be out of here in the next few hours. The membership drive will be over. We'll all be coping with whatever is coming down over this next week and several weeks to come. But you can bet one thing, we'll be here serving this community at 1-888-34.
And joining us now is Pat Mitchell. She's president and CEO of PBS, and she joins us from Los Angeles. And thanks very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Pat Mitchell has just signed a new contract, extended her term as a president and CEO of PBS. Congratulations, by the way.
Well, thanks. I feel like it's exactly where I want to be. We've got a lot of good work ahead.
We just heard that clip of tape from a recent fundraiser at WHYY in Philadelphia. Does PBS have any control over how individual stations do their fundraising?
PBS is interested, as we always would be, in servicing whatever our stations need to keep themselves financially viable and relevant and valued in their communities, Neil. But membership is handled at a local level, just as a lot of programming decisions are as well, because local autonomy and essential localism is really the basis of the public broadcasting system, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
What we have encouraged is that in seeking to bring new members in, as well as to keep and satisfy current members, that we use all membership opportunities as a way to remind people of the uniqueness of the programming, the distinctiveness that public broadcasting brings to their community. And we at PBS offer programs that, in general, are a part of our regular schedule, the kind of programs, the history documentaries, the children's programs, the drama that we would offer at all times. And the amazing thing, Neil, is as I've traveled around the country, is that these membership drives are responsible, as you probably know, for sometimes more than half and sometimes up to three-quarters of the revenue that supports the station. So any way that we can help strengthen that for them and keep it a viable form of relating to the community, we want to do that. But they make their own decisions, as they should, because they are reaching out to their own communities.
I'm going to ask you the question that I asked Paul Fari at the beginning of this program. Is, in a sense, PBS's public television a bit adrift? Has it lost its purpose, its reason to be?
I think there's never been more need, more purpose. Never felt that public broadcasting was more essential, Neil, than I do now. And that's just not my opinion. That's the opinion I hear all over the country. In this position, I've traveled to more than 120 communities, meeting with community groups and the station boards. And everywhere I go, people say to me, thank goodness there's public broadcasting in this cluttered media environment where, in some communities, there's no local media in town, except often for public radio and public television. And I think that matters, and I think it matters more and more to people that they feel the local connection from their community station. And then when you add to that, that in the push, especially with global conglomerates and the ownership consolidating, the push that means for commercial media to meet the bottom line, to make profits, to increase their revenues, that kind of pressure is in some places, you know, not producing the best results programmatically. And so to have an alternative, to know that in your community there's one media enterprise that isn't going to make its programming decisions based on ratings or revenue, that it's really going to make those decisions based on what the public needs and what is missing in the rest of that landscape. So in actuality, I think we have an opportunity now to make the case for public broadcasting is more essential than ever in this country and, in fact, around the world.
You say your decisions aren't driven by a revenue or audience share, but those things are clearly important. Both are dwindling, and isn't that sort of a condemnation? Aren't people voting with their remote controls?
People are looking at a lot more choices, so there is no question there's been a proliferation. With the proliferation of choice, we've fragmented the audience. But, you know, the last couple of years, PBS has held its share of that audience, which says a couple of things to us, that the audience who care about the programming, who want top-quality, non-commercial, uninterrupted programming, are there. What our challenge is to make sure that we raise the awareness among groups who might not be ordinarily coming to us, you know, of the programming fair that we're offering. So in some ways, while others have been losing audience, we've been maintaining our part of that audience. Now, do we want to grow it? Yes, absolutely.
Here's an email question we got from Bruce in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's evident to me, he writes, that PBS has become increasingly influenced by corporate interests. It's now peppered with numerous advertising spots from many of the largest and most politically powerful companies. I've noticed that the viewpoint in the news in particular has gravitated toward a decidedly business perspective rather than a public or community one. I no longer consider it as a media resource that is focused on civic matters or public education, rather more of a corporate shell masquerading as one.
I take that kind of criticism very seriously and feel that we need to do a better job of making it clear what our guidelines are regarding corporate sponsorship, because we have very strict ones. We, first of all, don't allow anybody to show product on our air or to do a call to action, so we are, in fact, not airing commercials. But we are, in fact, acknowledging corporate America who steps forward and supports our programming with their funding, but we're doing it in ways that I would not call commercial. And it's very important to say again to that viewer and all others that the corporate underwriting of shows, you know, has nothing to do with the editorial nature of those programs. They're completely separate. The underwriters never see the programs or have no influence or say so whatsoever.
Again, it's an issue that is endemic to public television and public broadcasting in general, over which you personally have no control. But many people complain about the overlap of too many public radio stations, that NBC and CBS get around the country with about 220 signals. Public television has about 350, and that this is an unnecessary expense and burden, those extra 150 stations.
Well, you were right, Neil, to mention I have no control over it whatsoever, because, in fact, PBS itself doesn't own Spectrum or have broadcast licenses. Those are granted by the FCC. And I think you have to look a bit historically to get the right answer to that question, because the one thing that the Public Broadcasting Act made clear was that every American is entitled to free, over-the-air public broadcasting. And so before the days of cable and satellite, to make sure that was happening in every community to 99% of the public, licenses were granted that now overlap because of the new technologies and distribution systems. So what that has meant for us internally is to become very cost-effective and strategically use technology ourselves to make sure that we are delivering differentiated services. And that's something that we are addressing with our stations on an ongoing basis.
I know you have to leave for another appointment, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you for devoting this time to the subject.
Okay, thanks. Pat Mitchell is president and CEO of PBS. She joined us on the phone from Los Angeles. Still with us is Paul Fahrey of The Washington Post. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email is totn@npr.org. And let's talk to Bob, who's with us from Davenport, Iowa.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'm a former host and producer of a PBS television series that had a 1,300,000 people watch it every week. And I'm a great supporter of PBS, and I still love PBS, about 90% of my viewing. But the problems that we had, and we're still doing productions, but we're doing it on commercial television, were, first of all, the affiliates, and then secondly, the underwriters. The affiliate is such a loose-knit organization of stations, and you said it before that they play, you know, they play it's a home improvement show. They play at 4 o'clock in the morning in Houston, and they play at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday afternoons in Detroit, and that was very tough. But the biggest problem were underwriters. Now, by law, underwriters can't have editorial control over shows, but we found it cost $2 million a year to do 26 shows. Because PBS standards are so high, it's very expensive. And one day an underwriter came to us that was giving us half that money every year and said, well, we don't like what you're saying about like vinyl siding, and if you don't start promoting vinyl siding, we're going to pull the million. so I said, pull it, and we left PBS. It was a very, very bizarre situation. And then going out and trying to sell underwriting to corporations, they want you to quantify it as advertising, and it's nearly impossible to do. It's a very frustrating experience for us.
Bob, what was the name of the show?
About Your House with Bob Yap.
Okay, I assume you're Bob Yap.
I am.
Okay. Paul Fari, is this typical of what program producers say?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they know when they come to PBS or to the public stations that they're not going to get editorial control. In fact, this is an article of some faith at public stations. You know, of course, the pressure is always to push a little bit more for the sponsor, for the underwriter. But I think in general, PBS has resisted, public television has resisted pretty well the inroads of the underwriters in trying to take over the nature of the programming. You know, obviously there are going to be individual cases and individual stations. There are 350 of them. But I think in general they've sort of cleansed themselves fairly well.
Well, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, our show is very preservation-oriented, has gone to several of the PBS home improvement shows and begged them to quit perpetuating anti-preservation messages. And what they have said is, we can't do that or we'll never get underwriting. If we tell the consumer the truth, we will never get underwriting. And I hear this from producers of PBS shows over and over and over again, that they have to kowtow to the underwriters big time. And I find that very scary.
Okay. Well, I think the real pressure here is that as underwriting declines, and it has been declining because of the recession and the stock market and what have you, there is going to be editorial pressure on the producers, and it is something to watch. I don't know that it's become a serious problem, however.
Bob, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with your next project, whatever it is.
Okay, bye-bye. Right,
bye-bye. We've gotten several emails that come in. Basically, this is typical of them. This one from Darwin. Why can't American broadcasting operate like the BBC?
You want me to try that one?
You want to try that?
Well, I think the answer probably is both a bureaucratic one and a financial one. Bureaucratically, the BBC is run centrally from London. It is operated more typically like a commercial network, although obviously it's non-commercial. And then again, back to what I said earlier about the funding. There's a mandatory license fee for every television set in England. Whether you like it or not, you're paying $200 a year to support the BBC. We have nothing like that in this country, and I doubt we'd ever be able to match that. So the BBC has, by a factor of three or four, the funding of what every public station in America combined has to produce what they produce. It's not a fair comparison.
Also, Congress would have to get involved and change the structure of the whole organization. In any case, we're speaking with Paul Fari of The Washington Post. We're discussing the future of public television. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on. Lynn joins us from San Francisco.
Yes, greetings. I am an independent filmmaker in San Francisco. My two of my works have appeared on KQED here. And what I found generally is that for independents, it's very difficult to get our work on public television. And I feel that public television should function as a community television access place more than it does.
Paul Fari, this is an eternal debate. I don't mean to belittle it in any way, Lynn, but it's something that's come up repeatedly over the years. And I understand that public television is, in fact, trying a new approach. Paul, is that right?
Well, they've had this pressure on them since the very beginning. You know, community television was what it was once known as. Educational television is what it was once known as. It's become more corporate. It's become more bureaucratic. Money factors are always an issue, more so in this more competitive landscape. You know, they're constantly fighting this. I think, though, that what they might say, without trying to be arrogant about it, is there is public access television on every level. local cable system. That is an outlet for some more of the community programming that, you know, listen, I mean, you have 24 hours a day, which sounds like a lot. But once your commitments to the Barneys, the Sesame Streets, the Frontlines, and the Masterpiece Theaters, the time gets used up very quickly.
Okay, Lynn, thanks very much.
Yes.
One question before we let you go, Paul, and that is, how serious is the financial crisis that's afflicting public television at the moment?
I think it's serious, but I don't think it's catastrophic. I mean, I think that public television has faced periodic waves of financial difficulty. This one looks more serious than those in the past for one major factor, that all of the major sources of funding for public television, that is corporate, pledge breaks, and government, are all under serious pressure now, and they're all declining. This is the first in the system's history. So that if this continues, you will see a continued diminishing public television and public broadcasting kind of base. It may well be a cyclical factor. The recession will be over at some point and things will be back on the upswing. But it really, really troubles people in public television because it's a first, and it certainly looks like it could last for a while. So they may muddle through, but when you're in the midst of the crisis, it looks like it's going to go on for a long time.
And this comes at the same time as the transition to digital broadcasting is coming on, and that's been mandated by Congress that public television do that. So
yes.
That's an additional very large burden. Let's get one more call in before we go. Sylvia's joining us from San Antonio.
Hi, Neil. I just have a couple of quick comments. I really appreciate PBS at the national level for a couple of reasons. I appreciate the lack of celebrity and self-promotion going on the network. You see, for example, in the World Series on Fox, they're talking about, oh, look who happens to be in the audience, and they're promoting the celebrities who are on their network television show. So PBS is a nice escape from the noise of commercial television. My specific affiliate here in San Antonio sends me letters asking for feedback, not for money. And I think that goes a long way for me personally. One curious thing that my affiliate does is show a lot of British programming, which might be endemic in all PBS stations, I don't know, but in San Antonio it strikes me as a little odd. Nonetheless, I think they do a fine job here, and PBS at the national level is just, again, a nice escape, an oasis, if you will, among all those cluttered commercial networks.
Well, Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Paul Fahrey, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Paul Fahrey is a Washington Post staff writer who has covered the PBS story for the Washington Post. He was with us from the Washington Post offices, obviously, here in Washington, D.C. When we come back from a short break, we'll discuss the new guide to style, metrosexual style, that is. If you want to know if you fit the definition of a metrosexual or want to help someone in your life achieve more metrosexuality, give us a call. The number is 1-800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us metrosexual email at TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.